Please call the case. Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed? Okay, Mr. Muzzi, you're going to be going first, and you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a warning light that will come on with 10 minutes to go, and Ms. Barbee will give you a five-minute warning with 5 minutes left in your argument. Okay? Please proceed.
Please, the court. Thank you for the opportunity to have oral argument today. And we are here today. It's been over 10 years since the alleged discrimination and retaliation occurred. This case has been on appeal for over 5 years since the ICA decided it. And that ruling sends it back.
Be sure to speak into the microphone.
I'm sorry,
yeah, thank you.
Is it all right if I move the microphone?
Yep, that's fine. Please.
So this case has been on appeal for over 5 years before the Intermediate Court of Appeals ruled, which ruling sends this case back to the Circuit Court for trial. Our petition for cert particularly focuses on the ruling on the motion for summary judgment because we do believe that that ruling was proper, that the court applied the proper standards, but that the ICA, in reviewing that ruling, did not apply the proper standards. They essentially looked primarily at the evidence submitted by the petitioner, by Mr. Lawless, the appellant. Much of that evidence was inadmissible. And apparently, it's not entirely clear from the opinion, but there's very, very little reference to the extreme volume of evidence that was submitted by JN and Mr. Markson. Your Honors, I'm not sure. This case has been extensively briefed, and I feel if you have particular questions, please jump in. But I did want to spend some time going through the evidence that was submitted at the motion for summary judgment, and I'll briefly go through the petitioner's evidence because it is voluminous. But if you were to look at the ICA opinion, I think on page 29, basically state 6 points that the petitioner had made in this case. But there was a lot more evidence. There was a number of declarations of Mr. Nicolai as to loans that he made to the defendant, as to not receiving any complaints, as to JN having an anti-discrimination policy. There was a declaration of Ms. Toma, who indicated that when Mr. Lawless was hired, she delivered a packet to him that contained the anti-discrimination policy. There was a declaration of Mr. Hill, who indicated, among other things, that he did not hear discriminatory remarks made to Mr. Lawless, that he was involved in Mr. Lawless's hiring, that Mr. Lawless himself had made discriminatory remarks about other employees, and when that was brought to JN's attention, Mr. Lawless was counseled, and the discrimination stopped. Mr. Markson Sr. testified regarding his meetings with Mr. Lawless. Mr. Markson Jr. testified as to Mr. Lawless's knowledge of a car not having air conditioning, which was the ultimate basis for his termination. Mr. Martinez submitted a declaration. Mr. Dempsey submitted a declaration. There's the termination report that indicates.
But doesn't Mr. Lawless's declaration and his deposition testimony provide a different view of the facts? And isn't it the case that the trial court is not supposed to weigh that evidence, but rather accept the evidence of the plaintiff in the light, or view it in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, in this case, the plaintiff?
That is an accurate statement of the standard, but I think what the court has to look at is the court has to look at the totality of the evidence that's submitted, and the court has to draw reasonable inferences. Mr. Lawless,
can you please cite to any cases in which we said that this court has said that the summary judgment standard is based on the totality of the evidence?
Well, I think the standard, and I can pull it and bring it up on rebuttal, would be that the court must look at all the evidence.
Right.
And I think,
but is there some case that says that we're supposed to weigh the totality of the evidence?
Well,
isn't the standard based on whether or not there is a genuine issue of material fact?
Well, I think what you have to do is you have to look at all the evidence, which includes all the evidence that's submitted by the moving party and all the evidence that's submitted by the non-moving party. And
so are you saying that your definition of totality is based upon the volume of evidence that one side presents as opposed to the other side presents?
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm trying to explain is that the court must look at all the evidence. But in this case, when you
so let's assume that you had five different affidavits or how many number you want to ascribe to this particular situation, which contradicted Mr. Lyle's affidavit. Is his affidavit sufficient alone in view? I'm just talking about generally applying the standard, sufficient enough to raise a genuine issue.
I would just say, Judge Browning, if you could speak into the microphone so we're sure,
and appreciate
ask
that.
All my colleagues to do so and counsel as well so we have a good record of our proceeding today. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Your Honor, it is possible that a declaration can supply the necessary facts to create a genuine issue of material fact. What I'm saying is that when there's significant amount of evidence that's considered, all the evidence has to be looked at because the court oftentimes draws inferences from the various evidence, and those inferences have to be reasonable. And if you don't look at all the evidence and you only look at the declaration of one person that was submitted, I don't see how you can determine whether an inference is reasonable without actually looking and considering everything that was submitted. In this particular case, we have some very significant problems with the declaration of Mr. Lawless that we believe that the declaration is essentially a sham. It contradicts other testimony that he's given, other exhibits that he's submitted on various issues, and that although the court is not supposed to determine credibility, the court does not have to necessarily accept a self-serving, uncorroborated declaration. In Mr. Lawless's material that I believe he submitted to the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, he identifies...
Mr. Mosley, excuse me.
Yes, sir.
One of the issues, I guess, the parties raise is whether or not Mr. Markson is subject to individual liability under, I guess, HRS 378-2. And apparently the federal district court has not come to an agreement on that. Although you cite to a Ninth Circuit unpublished opinion that affirms Judge Mulway's interpretation as saying that 378-2 does not allow individual liability. Is that decision, I guess it was Lum, binding on this court?
No. The Lum decision is not binding on this court. I think what happened is there was a split in the United States District Court, and after the Lum decision, I believe it was in the Costa Garden decision, the judges said after Lum, there hasn't been any decisions that are similar to Charest, and we don't believe after Lum that there would be.
Do you agree with Judge Mulway's interpretation that an agent must also be an employer?
I think that part of the interpretation may be difficult to rationalize, but I think the underlying decision is correct. When you look at 378-2-3, where when the legislature specifically intended an employee to be liable under that section, they used the word employee. What we're being asked and what the Intermediate Court of Appeals says is, well, the word employer uses the word agent, and an employee is an agent of an employer, so employer means employee. Well, I don't think it's that simple.
Does it make any difference? Did the plaintiff in this case plead 378-2, what is it, A3?
In this particular case, the pleading did not indicate that it was specifically brought under that section. There were no allegations of aiding and abetting.
Even if that wasn't pleaded, could subsection 3 still be considered as part of the trial, if there is a trial?
I don't believe that it's been adequately pled. I don't believe that there's any indication as to...
Why would a plaintiff not plead 3?
Your Honor, I can't answer that question. I think 3, from what I've read, in, I believe, relating to California, 3, California has a similar provision for aiding and abetting, and it seems that that provision is often used when you're dealing with third parties, such as a customer that comes into the store. And
but 3 is not related only to non-parties, right?
No, that's correct. It says employer, employee or not.
Employee would include Mr. Markson.
Yes, so he was an employee.
3 would make Mr. Markson subject to individual liability without question.
It appears that it's broad enough, but it wasn't pled in this particular case. I believe the complaint said that there was violations under Chapter 378, but there was never any allegation of aiding and abetting, inciting, or the other bases for liability under 378.
But aiding and abetting wouldn't pick up an employee or a supervisor who's acting alone. You have to aid and abet somebody. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's you're essentially a joint tortfeasor that you're assisting someone.
So if the theory was, the plaintiff's theory is that Mr. Markson was retaliating against the plaintiff because the plaintiff had complained, and Mr. Markson didn't aid or abet anyone in doing that, that was totally his decision or his judgment, then the aiding and abetting liability wouldn't be a proper basis of liability in those circumstances. That presumably would be why the plaintiff would have gone with arguing that he was an agent, reliable as an agent. Is that correct?
That's the way I read it, that I think the aiding and abetting, you have to actually show that there was essentially action in concert.
If that's the way you read it, what do we make of the rest of the sentence which says incite? For incite, do you need another person?
Well, I think because you're not
yes or
having,
no. For incite, do you need another person?
For incite, yes, you do, because there has to be someone else that's committing essentially the
discrimination. What about compel or coerce? Do you need another person?
Yes, because there's someone else that's actually doing the discrimination.
Doesn't compel or coerce refer to the person who makes the complaint or the complainant?
The way I read the statute is you're compelling or coercing someone else to perform an act that's prohibited under Chapter 378, that there's essentially you're assisting someone else in discriminating against the complainant.
So are you saying then that the legislature intended to exclude from any liability any supervisory employee from individual liability?
Well, I think there could be circumstances where a supervisory employee could have liability, but I think the legislature's intent was to...
I'm talking about individual liability.
Yeah, I don't think that there's individual liability for the supervisory employee. That person is essentially acting on behalf of the employer.
You're saying absolutely no individual liability under 378-2.
Well, I think that there, you could argue, a creative lawyer could come up with a situation that arguably could fit under the statute, but I think for supervisor liability, the employer was the one under the statute, and it's consistent throughout the legislative history that the legislature intended to hold the employer liable. There's public policy reasons behind that, and those would be that, the employer is the one that's best suited to bear the cost. They can pass the cost on to their customers. It could chill supervisors from...
So I guess your answer is yes. Under 378-2, you believe the intention of the legislature was to immunize all supervisory employees from individual liability and only impose liability on the employer.
That's correct, but I'm just with the caveat that 378-2-3 is very broad, and arguably there can be a circumstance that I can't think of today. I don't want to say that there was never any intent, because that provision is in there, but it doesn't appear to be designed to capture discrimination that's otherwise included under 378-2-1 and 378-2-1 and 2.
Is that a reasonable position?
I think it is, because I think, like I said, the public policy behind this is to hold the employers liable. You know, I think one of the problems that you would have is if you have a supervisory employer or supervisory employee that knows that he can be sued personally for making decisions such as hiring, firing, work assignment for discrimination, it's going to chill those decisions. It may actually lead to inadvertent discrimination because they may, if they have to choose between hiring two different people, they may subconsciously think, well, if I hire this person, you know, I may have problems, so I'm going to go with the safe bet, all things being equal, without, you know, stating any discriminatory purpose. So I think the public policy is well suited to holding the employer liable and not the individual employee. Did I answer your question?
You answered the question.
And I think, like I said, at least under 378.2.1 and 2, the legislature was clear. If they intended to have an employee liable, it had to be under that subsection 3. And that.
So you're saying, in essence, 3 is only subject to two people, at least a minimum of two people acting. Is that what you're saying?
Essentially,
so an employee would be liable, but only liable if he was acting or she was acting in concert with some other person. What is the rationale for that?
You know, I've seen that discussed that in the Sherez case. You know, why would you make a co-conspirator liable and not the person that actually committed the alleged tortious act? And I think the rationale behind that is that the supervisory employees, the employer picks up for what's going on, that provision under 3 was designed to encompass situations that went beyond essentially the discrimination that I don't want to say is common, but that the discrimination that's covered in the other sections, that essentially it's a catch-all. And I can't say that I've seen it applied, and in my research and preparing for the argument, it seems to be that it's not used very often, and that I believe California has some interpretation of their statute that has an aiding and abetting, and basically says it's not often used for employees. It catches mainly circumstances where you're dealing with third parties. But it's there, and it says employee, and I can't deny that there's probably circumstances that the legislature intended to catch with that. It's not entirely clear from the legislative history. The legislative history always talks about the employer's liability and what they want to prevent. And I think the goal of the anti-discrimination statutes is to prevent discrimination in the first place instead of holding people liable after it happens. And, you know, the way it's set up, it's designed to prevent employers from doing that. And that Section 3, is broad enough. It uses the word employee. And I believe there may be circumstances when they act in concert that it's essentially justifiable that they have some individual liability.
Well, Counsel, your discussion of the focus on the employer, I guess, perhaps could lead us into talking about the other one of the other issues in the case, which is JN's liability for the alleged discrimination by Marks. And now the ICA said that the Fairher defense wouldn't apply because there were questions of fact about whether there were, in fact, this the action was a tangible employment. There was a tangible employment action related to the discrimination. What's your response to that argument?
Yes, Your Honor. When you read Fairher, that is what Fairher says. It basically says if there's a tangible employment action, then the affirmative defense isn't available. But what you have to look at is the long line of consistent cases after that that talk about even if there is a tangible employment action, it does not per se preclude the employer from asserting the affirmative defense. Essentially, the case law, and I do apologize, I had a site that was incorrect, the Ferraro versus Kelwood site I had cited as 440 F3rd 992, and it should have been 430 F3296. The pin site at 102 was correct. And basically, it goes through the analysis, and it says that The word culminate means that the tangible employment action had to be linked to the supervisor's discriminatory harassment. And under this particular case, there's been essentially uncontroverted evidence that JN was told by a customer that on June 23rd, Mr. Lawless sold a car that he indicated had air conditioning. And the customer bought that car on, based on that representation. And then they came in the next day and
didn't Mr. Lawless actually controvert that statement? Didn't he say in his declaration that he did not tell the customer that there was?
He controverts the statement, but what he doesn't controvert is that the Smiths came in and complained and said that, that he told them an untruth. Because what's important under these rules is that what did the employer subjectively believe? The employer doesn't have to show that it was true that Lawless, Mr. Lawless lied to the Smiths. What he has to, what the employer has to show is that there was a reasonable, a subjective basis for the termination. And in this particular case, there is evidence that the Smiths came in and they only identified Mr. Lawless as lying about there being an air conditioning in the truck they bought. JN believed the customer. They put in air conditioning for that customer at their own cost. And that is evidence that that the Smiths came in, and there's their deposition testimony that sets forth that they came into JN, they complained, they indicated that Mr. Lawless had told them that. So there is a subjective, undisputed reason why Mr. Lawless was terminated. There's declaration testimony from Mr. Nikolai and I believe others that indicates that one of JN's principles is that honesty with the customers and that this type of behavior is not tolerated.
Doesn't Mr. Lawless say that it was pretextual?
Yes, he does say that it's pretextual, but under the law he can't just say, well, that's pretextual. There we've come back with a legitimate reason, and that legitimate reason was that he lied to a customer.
Was there any evidence that other salespeople had lied to customers and were not terminated as a result of that?
Mr. Lawless, I believe, had submitted a declaration of Ms. Smith that had indicated there might have been others that had talked about that. But the point being, that came in a deposition in preparation for trial. But all the information that was given to JN was Mr. Smith, who came in and complained and who only indicated that Mr. Lawless had promised him that there was air conditioning in that car. There was no indication that any other employee had lied to the Smiths. So at the time that the decision was made, JN only had information that Mr. Lawless had lied to the Smiths. So at the time when they actually made that decision, that was all the information that they had in front of them.
You're saying that we're supposed to disregard all the various different communications and complaints that Mr. Lawless made regarding his treatment, alleged treatment by JN and Mr. Marsden, that doesn't come into play in determining whether or not it was pretextual?
Not as to whether it was pretextual or not. No, the issue
does it come into play in any way with respect to this particular issue as to whether or not there was a genuine issue of material fact?
Well, what he has to show is that with particular evidence is that the reason for the termination was that the reason advanced, the legitimate reason that JN advances, essentially was false. And all he tries to distinguish it by saying, I didn't lie to the customer. He doesn't say that the Smiths came in and never said that to you. All he tries to say is, I didn't lie to them. But
doesn't he also say that he had complained a month before and that in his view, it was just a matter of time before he was terminated? I'm not saying he's right or wrong, but his view is, after this pattern of alleged discriminatory conduct, I complained. And at that point, the employer was looking for a reason or a pretext to fire me. And part of the reason we know it's a pretext in his view is that he was fired the day before and then unfired and then fired again the next day. Is that enough to raise an issue of material fact or not in your view?
It's not enough in my view. I think what he has to do, I mean, there's time. The proximity of time generally can supply a presumption. But we've rebutted that presumption by providing a legitimate reason for the termination. And so that the burden shifts back to Mr. Lawless to show that that reason wasn't legitimate or that it was false. You know, the fact that he believes it was pretextual just because of the timing of the alleged complaint, you know, doesn't carry the day. It's just a presumption. And once that presumption has been rebutted, the burden shifts back to him to introduce evidence to essentially create a genuine issue of material fact as to whether that decision was legitimate. And he doesn't attack it, JN's subjective intent in the firing. He only tries to attack it objectively, that he did not lie to the customer. So he hasn't come forward with evidence to show that it was JN that is lying or making up this reason for the firing. He's only tried to say that the reason for the firing was not correct based on his statement.
But are you requiring him to come up with some direct evidence, like an admission by someone in management that, oh, you know, this was pretextual? I mean, isn't the evidence that he advances in terms of the history evidence that could be taken into account in determining whether there's pretext or not?
The way I read the case law, he has to come up with specific evidence that attack the legitimate reason that's advanced by the employer, which would be essentially that the Smiths, they never came in and said that about me. You're making that up. The fact that the Smiths actually did come in and they actually did complain and they actually said that Mr. Lawless lied, those are all facts that he has not disputed. He's disputed that he's lied, but that goes to objectively whether or not the Smith story is true. It doesn't go to whether or not JN's reason for firing him is true. They fired him based on a customer complaint.
Yeah, I know. How much time is remaining? Okay, would you like to reserve that time, and in which case we can?
Well, unless of course the justices have any.
I think at this
questions.
Point, if you'd like to reserve that time for rebuttal, we can go ahead and.
I'll do that.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you.
Ms. Barbie, argument.
Good morning, honorable justices. Thank you for allowing us to present our argument in this matter. We are of the opinion and request that your honorable justices affirm the Intermediate Court of Appeals and strengthen the Intermediate Court of Appeals with respect to this discrimination and on the basis of ancestry. In this complaint, there are several counts. Count 1 and 2 rely on Hawaii law. Count 5 and 6 rely on Title VII law. This was an amended complaint because Mr. Lawless pro se filed his own complaint in federal court. When we first filed this case, it was based on state civil rights violations. We subsequently amended it to include Title VII. With respect to state civil rights, it is by law and by case law that individual supervisory personnel, employers, and employers can be individually liable. I noticed that Mr. Muzzy said he didn't know of any situation where this could occur. But we have a whole lot of cases, stare decisis, where individuals have been found by this court to be liable. For example, Steinberg versus Hoshijo. Dr. Steinberg was an employer, and he was individually liable as a supervisor when he sexually harassed an employee. This shows that the interpretation of this court, as well as the interpretation by the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, allows individual liability. You could also look at the amicus brief filed by the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, which discusses in detail and presents history of the legislative intent for the civil rights in Hawaii. Our Constitution, which was created in 1950, was one of the first states to enforce and to ensure that citizens had a right to be free from discrimination based upon ancestry. This Constitution predates the Title VII, 1964 Civil Rights Act. And from that Constitution comes a long body of law, and finally a creation of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission in 1989. But prior to the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, we had civil rights being enacted, for example, by the Honolulu Liquor Commission, enacting and enforcing civil rights laws.
Ms. Barbie, let me ask you about Hawaii Administrative Rule 1246.175.
Yes.
What does that apply to in terms of your different counts? What does that rule affect in terms of your claims?
All right. It goes to counts one and two, which are based on the Hawaii Civil Rights Law. That particular rule was enacted pursuant to the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission's authority and under Hawaii Revised Statute 91-4 administrative.
Let me ask you, do you need that rule?
We do need this rule. And the reason
why do you need that rule?
The reason we need this rule is it specifically says that a supervisor would be strictly liable for for his or her ancestry slurs, ancestry harassment. And it's important because it also specifically states, well, it has been used to say that the Farragher defense, affirmative defense, does not apply in Hawaii civil rights case law.
Now, you know the ICA sort of treats this as a hybrid. It says strict vicarious liability, which in the law I think are separate theories. But in this particular case, I think a lot of the amicus briefs take issue with this rule, because the idea being it goes beyond whatever power was given to the, I guess, the Civil Rights Commission. Is Respondeat, and maybe I've been around too long, but is Respondeat Superior still available for you to prove liability?
It is available, yes.
So you could say that Mr. Markson, for example, was acting in the scope of this employment, and therefore that makes J.N. liable for his actions.
True.
So why do you need strict vicarious liability?
Well, because that particular rule was enacted pursuant to administrative procedure rules, which allows the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission to enforce very strongly the anti-civil rights, the anti-discrimination laws, which permeate from the Constitution and permeate from Chapter 3.
I'm just looking at the fairness of it all, because strict liability means the employer is liable whether the employer intended it or knew about it. Vicarious liability means the employer is liable for the acts of its employees or agents, even if it didn't know about it, didn't intend it, etc.
True.
So what in the legislative history would indicate that the legislature would have approved of a rule like this, which seems to put a lot of weight on one side of this equation?
All right. Well, as previously stated, the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, as well as the Hawaii State Constitution, have a very strong policy against discrimination and for civil rights, people's civil rights. This particular rule basically enforces and ensures that that policy is carried out in this state. For example, you could have, when an employer hires a manager, and this only applies to managers and supervisors, it doesn't apply to co-workers or employees, co-employees, but those managers, quite often, the employer may not even be in Hawaii. The employer may be a corporation. So it's the managers who are the personalities, the people who are there every day. They hire, they have a lot of control. They hire, they fire, they demote, they promote. They are the hands-on people. And if you have this rule will make sure that the managers comply with civil rights rules. Because without this rule, they could, let's say, be mad at the employer and say, okay, I'm going to terminate all women, for example, and I don't care. Okay? And in that situation, you only have to go against the employer if you don't have this rule. But with this rule, you can go against that particular manager and say, not only did the employer violate the civil rights laws, but the manager did so. and he would be individually liable. So it strengthens civil rights. It makes employers, number one, make sure that their managers follow the civil rights laws. It also makes managers who have a lot of authority and power in the employment world to comply with civil rights laws.
Actually, Ms. Barbie, doesn't Hawaii HRS 378-1 define employer to include agents of employer?
Yes, it does. It does include agents of the employer.
Would a supervisory employee be an agent of an employer?
A supervisory employee would be an agent of the employer. Yes, that's true. But they should also be individually liable for their discrimination.
If that were true, Ms. Barbie, what does the rule say? An employer is responsible for its acts and those of its agents and supervisory employees. Wouldn't that indicate that at least the commission interpreting the statute construed agents as being different from employees and specifically different from supervisory employees?
Well, you would have to take a very broad
No, I'm just asking you about
definition.
This specific rule, which makes a distinction between agents and supervisory employees, indicating that supervisory employees are not agents, but a different category of people.
I see, yes. Well, you can understand that a supervisory employee can be an agent, or an agent could be somebody else. For example, an agent could be an employment agency, a third party.
So when the legislature in 378-2 talks about employers, let's see, what is it? In 378-1, I'm sorry, and says that an employer is someone who is any person and any agent of such person. Any agent of such person then would not be an employee. An agent would not be an employee in the definition of employer.
Going back to the history, my understanding is that an agent can include someone who is not an employee, and a supervisory employee may not. It encompasses the situation where you have more than one company involved in a discrimination act. You could have the situation where someone who is hired as an independent contractor is working on the grounds and engages in discriminatory acts. That person isn't necessarily an employee nor a supervisor, but an agent if the employer contracts with that person. And that has happened in certain situations. I've seen it happen where they have an employment agency that comes in, someone who comes in and discriminates, or they hire someone. For example, an employer may hire someone to do screening for hiring someone, an independent agent, an independent company. And that company has codes not to hire certain people who, for example, have arrest of court records, or for example, were of a certain color. And the employer thinks, well, because I hire this independent company the agent, that I won't be liable for the discriminatory acts. It has happened. I have seen that in some certain cases. So I hope that answers your question. There is a need, and the Constitution, the legislative history show that our state has a very broad liberal policy of making sure employers,
let me ask you
agents,
about, sorry, let me ask you about 378-2A.
Just a second, if you could speak into the mic, I'm sorry.
Let me ask you about HRS 378-2A3. Would the facts of your case fit under A3?
Aiding and abetting?
Yeah. Well, it says not only aiding and abetting, inciting, compel, or coerce, or the doing of any of the discriminatory practice.
Sir, it does. It absolutely does. And this is what was argued in my response to the summary judgment motion. It was also argued to the circuit court judge, the lower court judge. He asked questions about this. What is this aiding and abetting? And it was responded, it was briefed and presented to the court. And yes, we did argue.
So under that provision, you could sue Mr. Markson individually.
Yes. And
that's pretty clear because it says any person.
Absolutely clear. And as well as not just Mr. Markson, but Mr. Martinez as well. I know Mr. Muzzy said, well, you need two people. We do have, in this particular situation, two people, even more than two people, making the slurs, ancestry slurs against my client, and treating him differently because of his national origin and ancestry. Does that answer your question?
But your argument is that the legislature intended to go beyond just the aiding and abetting liability and also impose liability on the individual employees as agents under the definition of employer. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Okay, and so what would your response be to the argument raised by the employer that the fact that the legislature was very specific in talking about employees in the context of the aiding and abetting, but then was not as explicit in its reference in the employer section in defining employer, that somehow indicates an intent that the legislature intended to only go as far as aiding and abetting liability and no further?
Oh, I see. Well, in response to that question, I would say look at the body of law, stare decisis in Hawaii. Look at the case law, which has ruled that supervisors, managers, are individually liable. You could even look at the University of Hawaii, State of Hawaii versus Hoshijo, where indeed that particular case involved an individual liability for an assistant basketball coach as well as the University of Hawaii. And the case was against both of them, not just one. And there was no ruling that said, oh, what is this? You can't hold him individually liable. There was no ruling. So this issue has been presented to the court. There's a body of law which has found individual liability. And in this particular case, unfortunately, the federal court, with regards to the Lum case, got it wrong. If you read the Lum non-precedential Ninth Circuit case, it doesn't address Hawaii's legislative history. It doesn't address Hawaii cases. It merely, in a very four-page summary, says, okay, we affirm Judge Maui's ruling. And if you look—
Going back to the reading of 378-2, I guess the employer, as the Chief Justice indicated, makes the argument that when the legislature used the term employer in describing discriminatory practices under A1, it lists different types of discriminatory practices, but only talks about the employer. But when it talks further on down in that section about an employee in subsection 3, it would seem, just from a plain reading of the statute, that at least when the legislature used the term employer, it was not referring to an employee. Because when it did want to refer to an employee in this so-called aiding, abetting, et cetera, provision, it referred to employer and employees. So it did know the difference, or at least manifested the difference.
If you look at the amicus given to you by the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, they actually address the legislative history. And on page 4 of the brief, it specifically states that the definition of employer prior to Chapter 378 was based upon Act 44, 1964, which defined an employer as any person having one or more persons in his employment and includes person acting as an agent on behalf of the employer and also one or more individuals. But
there is a difference between an employer and an employee and a supervisory employee.
Absolutely.
Correct? A supervisory employee could be an agent of an employee, whereas a regular line employee may not be an agent of an employee.
Absolutely.
So would that be one way to distinguish A3 from the fact that the word employee is included in A3 and is not included in the other statute?
That's correct.
The other sections? You know, I also notice, I do have another question. I'm kind of going somewhere else. The ICA did not address the Farragher affirmative defense, found it was not necessary to do so because there was a tangible employment action.
True.
I'm wondering if this case is remanded, whether your complaint includes a claim based on the pre-termination allegations of harassment. In other words, even if the fact finder were to find that the termination was not pretextual, does your complaint still include claims for harassment for the pre-termination allegations of harassment?
Yes, it does.
So do you believe this court needs to address the Farragher affirmative defense?
No, I don't believe this court does.
Okay.
What about the ultra-virus argument by the amicus briefs? Does this court have to address that?
May I? First of all, this was not raised in the lower court. Under the Pelley defense case law, if an issue is not raised for the lower court to decide, that quite often this court decides.
You mean at the trial court level?
Yes, it was not raised at the trial court level. It was only raised once it was presented before the Intermediate Court of Appeals by amicus, as a matter of fact.
Right, and the ICA decided not to decide it.
Correct.
But the issue here would be, if in fact this rule violates the law, that is, it is outside of the jurisdiction of the commission to adopt, and we send this case back for an application of that rule, which, assumably, if it is invalid, will be applied in your case, wouldn't we be then upholding the application of an invalid rule, which would result in, I guess, an outcome tainted by what would be an illegal rule or an illegal law?
Well, I disagree that it's an invalid rule. And
that aside, if assuming that that's the case, don't we have to decide that issue, whether or not this rule, which is at this point, at this stage of the case, going to be applied, whether or not that is a valid rule or not? Because if it is an invalid rule, but we send it back for decision, then the outcome would be, as I said, tainted by the illegality of the rule.
Well, if you rule it's invalid, isn't it up to the legislature to decide whether or not this rule is invalid? Isn't it legislating to say this rule is invalid? This matter has been presented previously to the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission. There have been hearings held on it. The rule has not changed. Certain people have gone to the legislature to try to change the rule. If this court rules it's invalid, is it not legislating?
At times we do rule that statutes are invalid.
Isn't it up to the state legislature to make that decision? All this rule really says is that the Farragher will not apply when it involves managers. And in this particular case, it's clear that Gary Markson was the manager.
Now, I have no problem with that, except it takes away any concept of people being culpable for what they do, knowing that what they do is wrong. Here, the statute removes all principle pertaining to personal culpability. Therefore, you know, the employer is wrong, even if the employer issued a rule saying you don't do this. The employer didn't know that this was happening, didn't intend it for it to happen, but still would be liable. Same thing, I guess, and not only liable, in it, I guess, as far as the entity is concerned, but liable with respect to whatever the individual person who commits a discriminatory practice would be liable for.
Well, if you read the rule, it only applies to supervisors and managers.
Yeah. Supervisor,
so
right.
So coworker who sexually harasses another person. Or,
yeah. A supervisory employee, I think, as the commission itself recognizes, not an agent first. And second, that a supervisory employee is still an employee. I mean,
but they're in
a separate and aside from what the employer is.
Well, a supervisor, employee, and a manager have a lot of power, and I don't want to keep arguing with this, but a lot of times they're the ones who are supposed to make sure that everybody's following the law, the coworkers are following the law, and supposed to make sure that there is no ancestry harassment in the workplace. And if they are the ones that are perpetrating and committing these slurs, such as in the case of Mr. Lawless, where he's being called all kinds of names based upon his French ancestry.
And if they are acting in contradiction to the direction of the employer and without the knowledge or intent of the employer, we still hold the employer liable for their actions also.
You should be, yes. Definitely, I should be. But then again, the individual himself or herself, the individual supervisor manager, should also be individually liable for their acts, because our Constitution says our citizens should be free from discrimination on the basis of ancestry.
Ms. Barbee, coming back to the rule imposing strict liability, now that rule actually dates back, if I understand correctly, to a period in time prior to the creation of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, so when the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission was created by the legislature in the late 1980s, that rule, which, if I understand correctly, essentially adopted the same position as the current rule, and please correct me if I'm wrong, and by either counsel, was in effect, and yet the legislature, in adopting the statute governing the HCRC, chose not to act or preclude or do anything to indicate disapproval of that pre-existing rule. Is that right?
That is correct.
And what inference would you draw from that lack of action?
That the inference is that this is stare decisis, this is law. Cases have followed this particular rule, and that it is not, that this is what the legislators intended. As I said before, there has been no there have been amendments to the civil rights law, but they have not amended that particular portion.
Ms. Barbee, can I ask you, you said stare decisis, which I suppose means case law. Is there any case law that has construed this specific rule?
Not the ancestry, but the sexual harassment that, like I stated, the case law Steinberg versus Hoshijo is one of the cases. There has been administrative cases before the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission. I believe Sparky Mimi was one of the cases, and it's cited in the brief, where individual liability was held upon a manager, owner, and the company. That is one of the cases I can cite to. There are other cases like University of Hawaii, Nelson versus University of Hawaii, that's a Supreme Court case. And in that particular case, Nelson sued not just the University of Hawaii, but the actual professor who sexually harassed her. And
no, I understand that, but I'm talking about this strict vicarious liability concept in the rule. Has that ever been the subject of a court case, an appellate case?
The ancestry portion has not. This is the first time it's reached on the ancestry portion of harassment. But as for the sex harassment, there have been case laws. They haven't specifically said, oh, we found this particular rule to be constitutional, but they have addressed the body of harassment and civil rights laws. But again, I would urge you to consider the history, the need for such a rule, to make sure that civil rights laws are enforced in the state of Hawaii by employers, to not allow supervisors and managers to get away with harassment of its employees. It does not apply to coworkers. If a person is a manager, the employer should know what the manager is doing and train the manager to make sure the manager follows all laws. And if the manager doesn't follow the law, the employer and the manager are liable. They are jointly and severally liable. For example, in the Nimi case, the Sparky Nimi case, which had to do with a Big Island case, a flower company sexually harassed an employee.
Let me ask you, what is the practical effect of, say, suing the employer and the employee for the employee's act? What do you get more in terms of punitive damages? Is that where the difference comes in? I would assume compensatory damages would be the same, and so you wouldn't duplicate compensatory damages.
Well, the jury may find that the actual supervisor and manager who actually perpetrates the harassment may be 80% liable, and the employer may be 20%. That's really up to the trier of fact to decide. I mean, I assume that there would be appropriate instructions given to them. I really can't say whether the employer is the one that's going to end up paying. I mean, that's a damage issue, and that certainly isn't before me in this particular case. It could be that the employer will be the one holding the ball if the supervisor manager was terminated, which did not happen in this particular case. Can only speculate as to what could happen in the damage portion, but certainly there would be an instruction to that effect. But they'd be jointly and severally liable. It could be that a manager who engages in discrimination act eventually leaves or something happens, and then the burden would be placed on the employer. I hope I answered your question. There was one issue that was brought up I would like to address really quickly. And that is the termination, which Gary Markson did, of my client, Mr. Lawless. Mr. Muzzy argued, well, Mr. Lawless didn't present any evidence or sufficient evidence to show it was pretext. That's untrue. Very quickly, if you look at the documents and the briefings, Mr. Lawless presented the sticker which was on the vehicle saying it was being sold as is. After Mr. Lawless presented the actual sales document, which specifically did not indicate there was no air conditioning. After Mr. Lawless pointed out that Joe Dempsey, his supervisor, was the one that signed the contract with the Smiths, and he wasn't removed at all, yet Mr. Lawless was removed. Also consider the fact that the day before, on the 23rd, Mr. Markson told Mr. Lawless he was being removed for not attending a sales meeting. Well, Mr. Lawless says, well, I wasn't given notice of the sales meeting. And then he was supposedly removed for not meeting the sales quota, and Mr. Lawless presented evidence showing that he had met the sales quota and was not the lowest lowest car salesman, the person who made the lowest sales in Joey and Wholesome Motors, and I noticed the red light.
Wrap up very quickly, very quickly.
So the evidence that Mr. Lawless did present was objective. He presented the as-is sticker from the truck. He presented the actual sales document. When a person buys a car, they don't just meet with a salesman. They go into the secondary inside of the car salesman office, and then they meet with that secretary, and that's where the sales transaction is actually made. They negotiate for a price, and Ms. Smith actually said that it was the person inside of the office who told her that this particular car had air conditioning. So we have pretext. He's being removed for something another person in the same employment in J. and Hosea's Motor also did, which was say that this car had air conditioning, and Mr. Lawless denies that he said that and can point to objective evidence such as the sticker and the sales contract which says there is no air conditioning. So I ask you to please affirm the Intermediate Court of Appeals decision and make it stronger. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Barber. Mr. Muzzy, your rebuttal. And if you could address the question that I raised about the history of the rule that we're talking about with regard to strict liability and whether it was in substance in effect prior to the creation of the HCRC and whether or what significance could be attached to the way in which the legislature did or did not respond to that rule when they created the HCRC.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll start with that question. I believe you are correct that the rule in substance was in place, but I think what the court's the ultimate arbiter as to what the meaning of the statute is. And this statute clearly does not impose statute did impose strict liability, it doesn't cut off affirmative defenses. And the Hawaii case law is routine that we will look to federal law. It's not binding on the state, but we generally look to federal law. And in this particular case, federal law has recognized the fair her defense. So irrespective of whether the legislature remained silent, it's still, I think, the task of this court to determine whether or not that rule exceeds the authority, the rulemaking authority of that entity.
And Mr. Muzzy, I'm so sorry. I didn't need to break it off. Please go ahead and continue your response.
I think it's near the end of my answer that, it's well briefed that we believe that the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission exceeded their authority, that it goes beyond the statute. And the fact that it may have been longstanding doesn't necessarily make it right. The statute says what it says. The rule exceeds the statute. It cuts off a defense that's generally available in Title VII claims. And that defense actually serves the public policy behind these statutes to try and prevent discrimination and not punish the employers after it's happened. And those are the points that are raised in the briefs and in Farragher. Sorry, Your Honor?
Yes, what is the definition of agent?
I think agent generally, I don't have the dictionary in front of me, but it's someone that's acting on behalf of another. And it is generally a broad definition, but I think...
Do you think the general manager is an agent?
I think that the agent term is intended to encompass respondeat superior liability, and that someone that's acting in their capacity of a management position may be considered an agent under the statute, but I don't believe that that means that they're intended to be liable, individually liable.
If the definition of employer is, employer means any person, including the state or any of its political subdivisions, and any agent of such person, would that indicate that an employer being a person means something other than an agent or an entity who is an agent of that person?
Your Honor, I think we all kind of recognize in this briefing that the issue and the way courts have looked at it and the legislative change, it's not entirely clear. And I think...
Well, if you use the term agent, employer, and employee in the same statutes, you would assume that if you meant agent to be employee, you would say...
Yes.
Or employee, or supervisory employee, like the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission did, saying agent or supervisory employee.
Yes, no, I do agree with you in that. And that was one of our points, that when they meant employee, they said employee. And under 378.2-3, I was thinking of a different statute. But when they meant to say employee, they did. And under that provision, they used the word employer and employee in the same provision. And what we're being asked to do by the ICA is essentially disregard the word employee because it's encompassed under the definition of employer. And generally, when you interpret a statute, you don't interpret language as surplusage and disregard it. So I do agree with Your Honor that using the definition or using the term employee when you meet employee and using employer with a definition that doesn't include the term employee specifically, that the legislature knew what it was doing, and that an agent isn't intended to necessarily encompass an employee.
Mr. Muzzy, you may very, very briefly wrap up if you wish, or if you have nothing further to add, you can stand it.
Just real briefly, I'll wrap up. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I think you guys are very fair to both sides on this, and I appreciate your probing questions. I just do want to note one thing, that when you look at the evidence that was submitted by Mr. Lawless, and you look at all the declarations that were submitted, I would submit that they don't comply with Circuit Rule 7, that they're not properly sworn to as true. They have some generic language that they're submitted under penalty of perjury, but nowhere do they say that the statements are true. I would note that the respondents in this case, because of our position, we don't support discrimination. We have policies against it. One of our big issues here is having the availability of the fair her defense in the event that the court does find that there is some sort of strict liability for employers. And that fair her defense allows the employers to further public policy by putting in programs that are preventative in nature and that would prevent the discrimination instead of punish it after it happened. Thank you very much.
Thanks to both of our counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you.